Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This is the first show, new show since the holidays. I want to wish everyone a happy new year. I'd love to say that 2017 can't possibly be worse than 2016, but we're doomed, so I won't. This week and in the coming weeks, we're going to look at the growing resistance to the Trump regime. First up this week is Billy Wimsatt. He's a veteran, progressive organizer, and activist. Billy will tell us what he's up to and what we might expect from the progressive movement over the next couple of years. Then we'll be joined by University of Chicago scholar and all-around mensch Harold Pollack. Harold is a mild-mannered professor who has been giving some serious thought to locking himself to a courthouse door or something. He's been thinking about the need for civil disobedience in the Trump era, and he wrote a piece about it in The Nation before Christmas. But first, I want to just mention a study that came out over a decade ago, but seems relevant today. It was by Jared Piazza, who was then at the University of Pennsylvania. He's moved on. I don't remember where. And Paolo Souza from the Queen's University Belfast. It's titled Religiosity, Political Orientation, and Consequentialist Moral Thinking. And it was published in 2003 in the Journal of Social Psychology. The Journal of Social, Psychological, and Personality Science. You can Google it. Anyway, the researchers conducted a series of studies designed to ferret out the ways that conservatives and liberals think about morality. And they looked at both religious and political conservatives. And what they found, and here I'll quote, was that religious individuals and political conservatives are highly insensitive to consequentialist, i.e. outcome-based considerations. Now, what does that mean? It means they, conservatives, tend to have solid black and white views of what is right and what is wrong. And unlike more liberal people, those views aren't shaped by the potential consequences of those beliefs. In fact, religious and political conservatism, and I quote, predicted a resistance towards consequentialist thinking. Now, this isn't one of those shady studies that equates conservatism with mental illness. One could argue, in fact, that it is virtuous to stick to one's principles regardless of the outcome, because that's the conservative mindset, according to this study. One of the experiments that they did found that conservatives were more sensitive than liberals to various social taboos, right? In one study, they asked respondents about their thoughts about breaking a promise. And they were given three choices. Either it is never morally permissible to break a promise, or if breaking a promise will produce greater good than bad, then it is morally permissible to break a promise. And finally, if breaking a promise will produce greater good than bad, then it is morally obligatory to break that promise. So more liberal-minded people were more likely than their conservative counterparts to see it as either justified or obligatory to break a promise if doing so will result in more good than harm. And that's because they looked at the results and they said, look, liberals think, yes, it is bad to break a promise, all other things being equal, but the results in this particular instance of breaking a promise indicate that it is morally acceptable or even obligatory to do so. And that's consequentialist thinking. Conservatives, on the other hand, were more likely to see breaking a promise as morally unacceptable, even when keeping that promise will result in some real-world harm. Now, the reason I bring this up is that we're going to see a very serious, aggressive push for a series of policies that are going to create a lot of harm for a lot of people. That's what's going to happen over the next, well, hopefully 4 years and perhaps 8 years. And as this happens, liberals and progressives will wonder how they can be so heartless. We'll ask ourselves how they can be so cruel. And it's important to understand that from from a conservative perspective, these things are simply the right things to do. And they will resist even considering the consequences. And this is really important. You can see this across a lot of different policy areas. Once you, you know, this was one of those studies. I read it many years ago. I interviewed Jared Piazza. And ever since then, I see it all over the place. So conservatives believe, for example, that social insurance causes people to become lazy, that it harms people in the long run, even if it helps them in the short term. That's a belief that they have. They think that it is ultimately immoral for the state to, quote, steal your tax dollars. And because they hold those beliefs, they won't consider the real-world pain that, say, cutting funding for health care or food stamps or defunding Planned Parenthood will cause, right? They think abortion is immoral, but they ignore a lot of the reality of what forcing women to give birth to unwanted children entails. They don't care if some new restriction makes women travel great distances for an abortion, or if that burden falls more heavily on poor women. They believe that that regulation hurts businesses and is bad, and they never think about the consequences of deregulation. We see this pattern again and again and again. And this also says something about how we discuss and debate these issues, because we have to recognize that we have different moral frameworks. We approach these issues with different ideas of what is right and what is wrong. So it's not enough to say, look at what will happen if you kick millions of people off of their health coverage. That message will reverberate with people on our side, but it won't cut through the noise to the other side. Of course, they are sensitive to political consequences. They do. Those in public office certainly care about being reelected, which brings us back to this week's show about the resistance to the total Republican takeover of government under Donald Trump. So with that, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back with Billy Wimsatt. Stay tuned.
Sometimes I walk all by myself. I don't want to talk to no one else. And I close my eyes and I feel the spirit rise. And it feels so good to me. I can tell I'm supposed to be. To me, lift me up, get me feeling free. Now take me by my hand till I finally understand. Yes, and then I know how it feels to be when my soul is in ecstasy, and I feel so strong when the spirit.
Welcome back. I'm still Joshua Holland. There's a good chance that you've never heard of my next guest, but are nonetheless familiar with his work. Billy Wimsatt is an organizer and activist extraordinaire. He has played a key role in establishing a bunch of groups that you are probably familiar with, like Rebuild the Dream, the Coffee Party, the Generational Alliance, the League of Young Voters. Billy, you're so busy.
Billy, dude, what are you talking about? I'm so famous. You're at the League of Pissed Off Voters. You know, you're just already messing it all up, Josh.
Well,
how you doing, man?
I'm well. Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I wanted to talk to you about a new project for the Trump era. Billy, what is Movement 2017?
So Movement 2017 was called Movement 2016 until very recently. And it was a project we started because, and people can go to movement2017.org to follow along while I'm talking. Basically, we knew there was like $1 billion that was going to get flushed down the toilet on this stupid election with candidates that no one was excited about. And so, and most of it was going to be spent on TV ads and consults and, you know, and so we said, you know, hey, there's all these movement groups out there that no one's ever heard of, like Florida Immigrant Coalition and Ohio Student Association, that are in these key battleground states that, you know, are going to get out voters that, you know, the candidates aren't necessarily speaking to, you know, and there's been so much energy around, you know, Bernie Sanders' revolution. But what people don't know is that the revolution is, you know, and the movement is, you know, we happened way before Bernie Sanders, and is rooted in communities, and there are all these incredible groups, you know, literally no one's ever heard of, that are doing incredible work, and, you know, and are going to get out the vote of young people and people of color and unlikely voters and pissed off voters. And, you know, and not only are they going to get out, you know, progressive voters, they also are going to be there the day after the election to work on issues and raise the wage and, you know, hold candidates accountable and make them better, whoever wins. So we said, you know, there's kind of a problem because, you know, most, even like really smart, informed, educated, you know, progressive, you know, I imagine like your listeners, you know, if you want to turn out the vote in, you know, in Florida, you know, yeah, you might know some national organizations that are, you know, great, like Move On or Democracy for America or, you know, Credo, that you can give money to nationally. But if you want to give money directly to people in Florida or Wisconsin or Michigan or Pennsylvania, who are you going to write a check to, you know, or put in a credit card? So we did that work for you. We spent, you know, 6 months of research on top of, you know, I've been doing this for 20 years, so I have sort of encyclopedic knowledge of, you know, what's going on in different states. And, you know, but we spent 6 months and we had 50 people, you know, who are also, you know, national networked, you know, trusted people, you know, give feedback on the list. So we created a really good, well vetted list of, you know, of groups, and we made, you know, that no one's ever heard of. And we made Movement 2016 like a good housekeeping site where you could learn about them, you know, check out their websites, and you could, you know, and so let's say you want to give $100, you know, in 2016. Sorry, I'm just talking about 2016. I'll tell you 2017 in a second. So, you know, you can either like find your favorite group and donate to them or donate to 10 groups, or a lot of people told us that's too complicated. I don't want to do that. I want you to just, you know, make an easy button where I can donate to all of them at once. So there's an easy button on there. It goes through Act Blue, and you know, we made it so you could donate to 45 groups. And anyway, so we helped move over $2.5 million, you know, which, you know, our goal is to move 1% of the $1 billion. So we moved not quite 1% of the $1 billion.
Right.
But hey, $2.5 million. And it went to 81 groups. It didn't go through us. We didn't take a cut. It's just like an online platform. So anyway, so we're doing the same thing again in 2017, you know, with the 2018 and 2020 states in mind, because 2018, the governor's race is incredibly critical for redistricting, you know, and then also, but we added a new feature to it because, you know, in fighting Trump, you know, there are all these scrappy national groups too, from immigrant rights groups like, you know, Cosecha, Mi Gente, you know, United We Dream, to, you know, Movement for Black Lives groups, to, you know, just scrappy disruptive groups like All of Us, and that, you know, all have relatively, you know, modest budgets where, you know, your donation will actually be noticed and felt, unlike, you know, huge multi-million dollar brand name organizations.
Right. If you give to a local nonprofit, if you give to a local grassroots group, it has a lot more impact than, you know, sending a check to, I don't know, the Planned Parenthood or one of these giant organizations. Not that they're not worthy of our support. Yeah. So this is a, do you think that this is part of a trend where people are finally looking at state and local races and giving them the placing on them the import that they deserve? Because I feel like ever since, I don't know, 2004, there have been a series of progressive groups that have kind of come and gone that were going to be game changers at the state and local level.
Yeah.
And yet they didn't really have much of an impact. So you think about like Progressive States Network and all these, you know, different things that pop up. Are we going to see more concerted attention?
People are still stuck on stupid with not understanding how critical local organizing, state organizing. So we're putting a lot of attention on Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, obviously, you know, as well as like Florida, Nevada, other states. And what we're talking to people in these states and they're like, thank you so much for calling us. Like, no one's calling them. They like, they feel ignored. Like, every progressive funder in America should be calling anyone they can find in these states, you know, to...
It seems like a total non-brainer, but I mean, progressive funders have misplaced priorities. That's not a new story. They've always been hesitant to fund media, and we see the progressive media getting just laps run around them by their conservative counterparts. Let me pull out a little bit and look at the bigger picture. Do you think that we're seeing the beginnings of the kind of backlash that could have legs? Or is this a reaction to the fact that Trump won 3 million fewer votes that will eventually pass? Are we going to get accustomed to this new era of Republican domination?
No, I'm actually really, I mean, you know, like, I'm of the mind that things are like even worse than most people think in terms of what we're up against and the policies. But I actually think in terms of on the movement side, you know, there's a huge silver lining, which is the movement is going to be even better than we expect it to be. You know, I mean, if you think about the modern progressive movement we have, it all, you know, it really went to a next level in the Bush years. Like, we really have Bush to thank for helping us build a much better progressive movement.
Yes.
And so the Trump years are going to force us to build the best movement of movements ever in the history of the world. Because, you know, we actually, you know, are the immune system of the planet that is like springing into action to save ourselves, to save our lives and our children's lives. So I'm seeing it happen. I'm very encouraged. You know, I feel like there are lots of streams flowing into the river where you're seeing, you know, Muslim organizations showing up at Standing Rock and, you know, all kinds of beautiful intersectional people coming together and, you know, and people moving back to their white working class, you know, town in Michigan to organize, you know. So, yeah, I'm seeing an incredible level of you know, excitement and activity, and yeah, it's pretty wonderful actually.
Now, what about our house? The left, broadly speaking, the broad left, right, seems to be pretty divided right now. There's a lot of lingering enmity from the Democratic primaries. I think that a lot of us, a lot of us on the media especially, kind of underestimated how deep the divide between the so-called activist left and the rest of the Democratic coalition has become. Do you think that's going to be an obstacle to an effective resistance against Trump, or do you think it will fade once he gets into office and starts ruining the country in much the same way that we put aside a lot of our differences during the Bush years?
Yeah, I think mostly number two, like in the set, like, you know, I don't think that the Wall Street wing of the Democratic Party is going to be, you know, any less Wall Street, but they can see the which way the wind is blowing. You know, like when all of us went and sat in at Chuck Schumer's office, you know, he's getting the message that, you know, like the Democratic Party, it's a paper tiger. It doesn't really exist. There's sort of like an establishment set of folks, and then there's the progressive base, and the progressive base is, you know, is ascendant. It's you know, it's rising. It's, you know, we were killing TPP before, you know, right, Trump came along, you know, and you know, smart politicians, you know, who are part of the establishment, you know, they need to either get with us or get out of the way from the, you know, just like the Tea Party did. And, you know, and I don't know what it's going to look like. And history is going to have a lot of, you know, mysterious twists and turns. It's actually a really exciting time to be alive, despite how horrible it is.
Right.
You know, and, you know, and so, I, you know, just the way that Hillary Clinton, like, moved way further to the left than any of us predicted, you know, as a result of Bernie and Black Lives Matter and pressure, you know.
I predicted it, actually.
You predicted it? All right,
yeah,
all right.
Yeah, I mean, I just said, look, this is where the median, the center of gravity in the party has shifted since the 90s. So I would assume that she wouldn't be the only one who would be immune to those shifts. Let me ask you this. Yeah. So, yeah. Okay, Progressive America is obviously going to be up in arms. The Republicans seem to be gearing up for a really maximalist agenda. And you have the reality, just a plain reality, that they hold the Supreme Court, a majority on the Supreme Court. They have both chambers of Congress. They have the White House. And they have a majority of state houses. So what pressure points do you see emerging in the next couple of years that we can exploit?
Yeah, great question. So I think you're right. We have to understand we're living in a one-party state. We're living essentially under some form of a fascist dictatorship. You know,
Kansas. The whole country is Kansas.
Yeah, you know, and look at the revolt that's happening against the establishment in Kansas. You know, like bright red Kansas. You know, picked up Democratic seats in the Trump wave year because, you know, they did so much terrible stuff. But, you know, so I think the beauty is now, you know, like, is we are clearly the underdog. Like Trump is actually the underdog in that election, you know, and he was David versus Goliath. We're now clearly, you know, we get to really own the underdog thing and lean into it. Like this is our test. Because, you know, we basically have 4 years, which start right now, to, you know, and people say, like, God, who are going to run in 2020? Like, who's going to be our standard bearer? But the way it works is, you know, you don't get to choose the standard bearer out of the gate. What you do is you build the best movement you can, like the anti-war movement that allowed Obama to take leadership and distinguish himself from Clinton.
Right.
You know, the Occupy movement that allowed the rise of Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and actually helped Obama, you know, win against Romney, right? So step one is build the most, you know, beautiful movement of resistance that you possibly can, and just, you know, pure, beautiful fight back. And leadership will emerge from that, that, you know, will turn things around. I remember in 2004, how demoralized everyone felt.
God, me too.
You know, Republicans
I think this is actually worse, but I,
It is worse. It's
but the parallels worse. Are there. After 2004, I was just desolate. Billy, let me push you here, though. Let me ask you the same question with a bit more specifics, right? I think a lot of people have been under the impression that we can exploit some of the divides that have been prevalent on the right. They're saying, well, look at Trump's rhetoric on trade or the fact that his agenda would blow this giant hole in the budget. And it seems to me that the right, again, I'm broadly speaking, has mm-hmm. come to an accommodation with Trump on these very issues. So they seem to be happy to have unified power and willing to let some of those ideological differences slide. So where does that leave us for, driving wedges into this larger coalition?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that question is a little bit tactical, you know, and I want to back up to what are we really for? What's our vision? What do we really want? You know, and Bernie Sanders actually made democratic socialism a normal thing. There was a Washington Post poll said most people want to replace Obamacare with single payer. So I think if we have learned anything from the last 8 years and the last year, it's that we have to stand up for the stuff we really believe in. We have to be bold and visionary and ask for, and that's what American people want. That's what a lot of Trump voters, you know, that when that poll included a lot of Trump voters actually went single payer. So, you know, so we have to be really clear and break through the noise about what our vision for the country is and how it's going to help, you know, a family of in Michigan, you know, and that is, and we have to just lean into that and magic will happen. Like I guarantee you, you know, and I don't know if it's 2 years or 4 years or 8 years, but the pendulum is going to swing back. It always does.
Yes.
And all the fundamentals, you know, we have a scammer in chief here. He is going to scam this country dry. And a lot of his voters are, you know, former Democrats who are pissed off, who just wanted to try something else because they're sick of the same old. And so we have a huge job right now. I'm talking to everyone who's listening right now. Like we have to become the greatest movement that's ever happened right now. Like this is it. This is our time.
This is the moment. Let me ask you this, Billy. Before I let you go, we're running low on time. It seems to me that there's this sort of strategy emerging in Washington. I don't know if it's an intentional strategy, but, you know, in Congress, we can certainly expect death by a thousand cuts. And mm-hmm. at the same time, you have this weird ability of Trump and his regime to kind of dominate the news cycle with nonsense.
Yeah.
How do we stave off outrage fatigue? We're going to get one screwed up thing after the other for years. How do we keep people focused and how do we prioritize? We can't go, you know, full on to the mattresses over every single thing. We have to choose our battles, right?
Well, yes. There's sort of a yes and, which is, you know, different people are going to choose different battles, right? Like we can't all fight every battle at the same time. And, we're actually in an existential war. Like picture you're in World War I in the trenches, you know, shooting. It's like, oh, I have shooting fatigue. Well, then you get shot and you die. That's, right. that's what happens, you know, to people who are in a war and don't realize they're in a war and are, you know, and so, you know, we have to take care of ourselves. We have to have joy in our lives and, you know, we can't just be angry all the time. Like most of how I operate every day is from just love and joy and building a team and our team is going to win. Like that is the spirit we have to transmit. Can't just be anger and upsetness and pain, you know, and, Basically, we are building a rising, swelling movement. You need to know you're on a winning team. You know, in 2 years or 4 years or 8 years, we're going to be celebrating and dancing in the streets. And we want to, you know, and we're going to have to do a lot of experimentation. The good thing is we don't have to do it alone. Like, get together with people in your neighborhood or one friend. I had one friend over today and we said, let's just have brunch, you know, once a month and scheme about this one thing that we're working on. You know, so just do it with community. There are more of us, you know, and check out Movement 2017 if you want inspiration. You know, you can, you know, find amazing groups in different places and not only support them with money, and you know, you can have a house party and learn about what's going on and support my support groups together and figure out where to volunteer and make connections. Like, these are things we can all do that bring us joy and a sense of purpose, even as we're facing a storm of poop, you know?
Yes.
And it's going to make, when we win and when we win on a platform, you know, of all the kind of things that we want, then we'll be dancing in the streets and then we can actually get, it's always darkest before the dawn. And so let's bring that dawn and let's bring it fast and let's bring it strong.
Billy Wimsatt with a optimistic note at the end. Thank goodness. Folks, I hear a lot of people in my circle are saying, what can I do? How can I get involved? How can I fight Trump? Check out movement2017.org. You can, as Billy says, even if you don't want to give them money, you can find local groups that are doing things in your community and you can get involved directly. Billy Wimsatt, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. I really do appreciate it.
Oh, you're beautiful. Thank you so much, Joshua.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back with Harold Pollack to talk about civil disobedience in the age of Trump. Stay tuned.
Caught in a bad romance. I want your ugly, I want your disease, I want your everything as long as it's free. I want your love, 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 I want your love. I want the drama and the touch of your hand. I want your leather-studded kissing in the sand. I want your love, 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 I want your love. You know that I want you, you know that I need you. I want your bad, your bad romance. I want your love, I want your revenge. You and me could write a bad romance. I want your design, cause you're a criminal as long as you're mine. I want your love, 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 I want your love, yeah. I want your psycho, your vertigo shtick. Want you in my rear window, you know that you're sick. I want your love, 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 I want you.
Welcome back to the show. My next guest is Harold Pollack. He is a professor who focuses on public health and healthcare policy at the University of Chicago. Harold, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks so much for having me, Joshua.
Folks, Harold had a piece in The Nation before Christmas. It was titled Thinking About Committing Civil Disobedience in the Age of Trump. Now, I think of you as a mild-mannered, wonky type of academic and not a bomb thrower. What brought you to this point where you're thinking about committing acts of civil disobedience? It does seem like a departure.
By the way, I am a mild-mannered, wonky, kind of centrist liberal type, and I still am. Trump's election has changed my sense of my own responsibilities as a citizen activist. It has not changed my policy views. In the universe of people who read The Nation and so on, I'm probably in the, towards the more moderate end. But there's something that is really different about the election of Donald Trump that calls into question both the moral legitimacy of his stance as president, and that also seeks to litigate some of the basic premises of a pluralist democracy in a way that makes me think that I have to be ready to behave in a different way as a citizen than I would if a normal conservative Republican were elected with whom I had very serious policy disagreements, but who had just prevailed in the democratic process. I think that there's something different going on here, and that wherever you are on the ideological spectrum, you have to really acknowledge that.
So, I mean, in the piece, you talk a lot about Trump's demagoguery toward Latinos and immigrants, his embrace of the so-called alt-right, the white nationalist movement. But yeah. I wonder about the more, maybe we could call it the vanilla damage that unified Republican control of government at this point in our history, with the Republican Party being a party that has kind of gone post-governance, possibly with a feckless Democratic opposition, that remains to be seen, is likely to produce. Because we're looking at deep, deep cuts to the social security safety net, millions of people being thrown off of their subsidized health insurance, maybe block granting Medicaid. They're going to defund Planned Parenthood, in all likelihood depriving lots of lower income men and women access to affordable care. Just one thing after the other. You talk about norm violations in terms of, calling Mexican immigrants rapists. Isn't these kinds of maximalist policy pursuits with a distinct lack of a mandate, right? Having won 3 million fewer votes than his Democratic opponent, isn't that enough to justify engaging in civil disobedience?
Well, that's an interesting question. I do think, by the way, there's an irony to the situation where I kind of trust Speaker Ryan not to do anything crazy with the nuclear codes. And I kind of feel like President-elect Trump wouldn't go out of his way to take away essential services from tens of millions of people. But the wrong man is in charge of each thing.
Right, and that's a really good point.
And they seem to have each made peace with the other in that respect. There's no question that the policy consequences of unified Republican government are terrible. Although I think that they're not a distinct mandate for President-elect Trump, but many of the policies that you just outlined are extremely unpopular.
That's right.
And the way I've written a lot about health policy in the age of Trump, and I've talked about the situation as one where the Republicans are kind of like the bear who's caught the car. You know, sometimes people say they're the dog who caught the car, as the analogy that, okay, they promised to overturn the Affordable Care Act for all these years. Now they kind of have to do it, even though it's politically very risky. They could really damage the American healthcare system along the way. I think it would be extremely damaging for them politically to do some of the things that they've talked about with ACA, but they may do it anyway. And there's no question on immigration, issues that go well beyond health reform. I think people don't realize that a lot of the changes that Republicans would like to do, for example, to the Medicaid program would go way beyond repealing the Affordable Care Act. You know, if you block grant Medicaid and give states sort of a fixed ration of money to support the program, and then allow that to grow much more slowly over time than the current budget line would lead it to grow, you are really cutting services to the elderly and the disabled, because that's the group of people where most of the Medicaid money is spent.
And children, and right? Just,
yes, and children certainly, and particularly children with special needs, because again, you know, most of the bodies on Medicaid are low-income people, but most of the dollars in Medicaid are going to people who have really significant challenges. The healthy 7-year-old needs to go to the doctor and has the occasional issue, maybe breaks a bone. The real money for kids in Medicaid is often spent on the 7-year-old who has cystic fibrosis or who has autism or diabetes and, you know, really requires stuff. So there's just no way to drastically cut these programs in a way that doesn't go after people that really have significant health problems, significant life problems. Now, so from a policy point of view, it's a disaster. I do think, though, that it is worth distinguishing differences in ideology and the fact that the Republicans have seized, have won big political victories from someone who campaigns for president on an explicitly xenophobic platform that uses an element of racial demagoguery. You know, there's the birther issue. You know, at one level, it's a lie, but it's not a lie like I didn't have sex with that woman. It's a lie like Holocaust denial. It's really a way of saying I'm going to flout the conventions of American society. You know, anybody who's talking about this, people are assuming is a racist, so no one's willing to say this. Well, guess what? I'm willing to say this. And to me, when he did that, that really was, to me, a signal that this is a dangerous person and that this is a person who is running against the most important values of American society, and that if he wins election, that his win is tainted, not because of anybody messing with any election machines or anything like that, but because he is specifically denying the bedrock values of a pluralist society. And that makes me think this is not a person that we can trust. And it's also a person that I have to think about differently in terms of my obligations to the office of the presidency when I think of myself as a citizen. That doesn't mean that I have a right to do violent disruption of the government or whatever, but it means that he has a lower level of political legitimacy than any president of my lifetime, and that I have to be willing to stand up against some of the things that he's pledged to do.
I don't disagree, but I would ask how you distinguish between Trumpism or Trump's appeal mm-hmm. to white identity politics, mm-hmm. if you will,
yeah.
and, you know, Richard Nixon's or the campaign George H.W. Bush ran against Dukakis. What was his name?
You mean the Willie Horton type?
The Willie Horton campaign, right? So, I mean, it's not a departure in terms of the substance. It's a departure in terms of making subtext into text, or am I wrong about that?
Well, I think making subtext into text is a qualitative difference. I do agree that, you know, President Obama said, you know, President-elect Trump didn't build that, and there's a lot of truth to that. Where I see the real commonality with President-elect Trump is with, for example, the Republican Party in North Carolina, where they have specifically made efforts to hinder the African-American voting, and, you know, efforts to do voter suppression and things like that. That in the case of North Carolina, you know, there have been a series of court proceedings where they basically did statistical studies to try to understand how African Americans were voting, and then tried to, you know, legally hinder those practices. And as the Republican Party cajoles to a group of older non-Hispanic white people, those you know, those strains in the Republican Party, which were always there, have become more toxic and more explicit. And for a variety of reasons, more potent in American politics. You know, we had many of the ways that the American political system helped keep a lid on some of those appeals to white identity politics. You know, clearly those mechanisms have weakened, and someone like Trump was able to take advantage and go beyond the dog whistle to the straight shouting of appeals to racism.
And in distinguishing between the kind of dog whistle politics and Trump's mm-hmm. more explicit enunciation of those views, yeah. How significant is it that he seems to have enabled the fringe ethnocentric right and given all of these white supremacists leave to mm-hmm. at least feel that they're part of the mainstream? Does that play prominently in your view of the differences?
Well, it certainly has made this election campaign season very different for me personally. You know, I've been very active in helping President Obama in 2008 and in 2012 as, you know, one of the cloud of people, you know, working, volunteering for the Obama campaigns and working for health reform. And I certainly would get a lot of hostile emails from people who supported, you know, John McCain or Mitt Romney. I never got anti-Semitic email and things like that. You know, I mean, maybe I got a couple. And this campaign season, I have just over Twitter, I get hundreds of things like that. I got emails that said things like, "I believe all Jews should be killed." And at the bottom, it says, "This is just an opinion. It is not a threat." And it's you know, and everyone that I know who has a vaguely Jewish name who's been active in 2016 has gotten the same stuff. You know, it's not that I am a distinguished person.
No, it's been widespread, and it's shocking. It really is shocking. I'm sorry to interrupt, Harold, but as an aside, you know, I'm not a religiously observant person, but I'm ethnically Jewish. I come from a Jewish background, and I grew up in New York, and I've never felt even the vaguest hint of this kind of explicit anti-Semitism until I moved to Europe and I saw some of it at the mm-hmm. margins, not in the mainstream, but at the margins. Yeah. And then prior to this year, I've never seen anything like this in American politics, even remotely like this. And this kind of outpouring of memes of, you know, reporters being stuck in ovens and gas chambers. It's just, yeah. it's crazy. It is really, I mean, I see what you mean in terms of the distinctions between kind of the more subtle dog whistles and this kind of overt anti-Semitism, anti-this and anti-that, xenophobia.
I should say, by the way, in a strange way, I'm glad I'm getting that anti-Semitic hate mail, not because I'm happy to get it in any way, and certainly not because I'm happy anyone else is getting it. But, you know, it's a reminder that you can't pick your bigotry a la carte. And it is, you know, Trump actually reminds me of a certain outer borough conservative perspective that's not totally unfamiliar to me from my elderly relatives and now deceased and so on. And I know, I mean, I know very well some of the patterns of mind that can lead to that. And it is actually a valuable reminder that, you know, if you support someone who says hateful things about black people and about Latino people and Islamic people, you know, you're setting loose, you're empowering a way of thinking about people, which is, you know, which can't be necessarily contained, and you should not assume that some other group that you happen to like or happen to belong to is going to be immune from the kind of hateful invective that's been let loose. And I don't, so there's a weird way where I almost want to thank these people for reminding me that, you know, it's because I'm sure, but certainly people I know who are you know, in any number of the groups that Trump has disparaged are in a much worse situation than I am to occasionally get an email that I have to delete. But it is very jarring, and it is an unfamiliar thing. I just haven't. Also in my life, anti-Semitism is just not a factor in my life very often at all. And so it's been kind of shocking.
Yeah, really. And, it really is. First, they came for the Jews. First of all, let me ask you this. What kind of civil mm-hmm. disobedience do you see yourself possibly participating in?
I've actually been doing it. I approach it like a professor. You know, I talk to lawyers and I do a lot of work with a variety of people, including a lot of people in law enforcement. And I really didn't want to have my colleagues either see in the paper that I had just been arrested or interpret what I'm doing as an attack on them. And so I've been, I think the way, and I also want to do it in a way that sort of matches, you know, I'm a respectable middle-aged professor dude. You know, I'm not a guy who gets out there and shakes a fist at people.
Right.
And I want to communicate to people. I see civil disobedience as an act of persuasion. And so the kinds of things I've been thinking about would be, you know, to go and lock myself to a door of a federal courthouse, something like that. I think I'm waiting to see what President-elect Trump is going to do. I think that particularly if he does things that violate the rights of a specific minority, that's really what's going to get me to do that. And the purpose of me doing civil disobedience would be to say, this is different. Like, pay attention. You know, I want to stand with the people who are being victimized in a way that is fundamentally unjust and comes out of, you know, a set of motives and attitudes that can't be accepted. I want to do it by myself. I don't want my students to come with me. I don't want my colleagues to come with me. I just want to go and speak my piece. And I'm not taking a huge personal risk by doing that, but I might be incarcerated for, you know, I might have to go to jail and pay a fine, you know, do something. To say, hey, this is how seriously I take it.
And when you looked into this, I mean, you did approach it in a very kind of academic manner. I feel that mm-hmm. from reading the piece, it kind of put you in touch with your own privilege to a sense, and you started to kind of see how others could face much more long-lasting repercussions from doing the same kind of actions. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, that is so true. In fact, it's very, and which makes me ambivalent about the enterprise, because I don't want it to be just, you know, a show thing. I'm a tenured professor at one of the nation's leading universities, and one of the privileges that comes with that is that, I talk to my colleagues and the, you know, administrators at the school, and I said, what would be the consequences for me if I got arrested for an act of civil disobedience, got convicted of a misdemeanor? And what I was basically told was that, you know, I have university responsibilities I have to do. They said, you know, don't charge, you know, I'm in jail, I can't charge my time to a grant. I talked to somebody who was fairly important in the university. He didn't particularly agree or disagree with my political views or whether this was a good idea, but he basically said, look, this is what you're supposed to do. You're a university faculty member in the public conversation. And what was interesting was all my colleagues I had very humane conversations with. People who in office politics wouldn't necessarily cross the street to pull me out of a mud puddle treated this differently. They're saying, because everybody, even, you know, across the ideological spectrum, University of Chicago is a pretty conservative place in a lot of ways.
Yes.
I would say almost everybody here is shocked by the election of President-elect Trump and by the values that he projects, which are antithetical to the values of a university. And it just made me, I mean, it was actually an experience of solidarity and of affirmation at a personal level and in a lot of other ways for me, that people didn't, a lot of people think it's not a great idea for me to do personally, but they really approached it in a very empathetic and humane way. and said, of course you're thinking about what you should be doing. Everyone's thinking about that. And I would, you know, as your friend, this is what I think about it, or as your colleague, this is what I think about it. And that is such a position of incredible privilege. And that's one reason why I have a responsibility to act, because I have to use that privilege in a way that helps people who have a lot less privilege. If I'm a 28-year-old kid, young adult, you know, on the DACA list, you know, I can't go and get myself arrested. I just can't. And those are the people that need the rest of us to really stand up for them.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. Harold, I want to tell you that when I was 12 or 13, I did a civil disobedience training. And then my father threw me over a fence at the Shoreham nuclear power plant.
No kidding.
And I was arrested with a bunch of hippies, and they put us in these giant tents. And somebody had a guitar, and it was it was quite a lot of fun. But of course, I was 13, and I was a rebel looking for a cause. Yeah. So the civil disobedience is near and dear to my heart. My parents, it wasn't a civil disobedience, but my parents met on a protest line. They were both in the teachers' union. They met on a strike.
Well, you know, those are very powerful experiences, and it is. I must say that, you know, I've been devastated by the Trump election.
Yeah.
But there's a clarity to the situation, and a common sense of purpose with a lot of people who are horrified by what's happened. That is very bracing, and that creates a lot of human connection. And we're going to need that, because we really have to, this guy has to be defeated. And both in terms of all the policy things that you just described, and the fact that I just think that he is a comprehensively unworthy person who has already permanently damaged the country by his election. And the thought that we could have, say, a crisis with North Korea with this guy as president is truly terrifying.
It is terrifying.
So we've got to really band together and stop some of the things that he is trying to do, or Republicans are trying to do, that would harm the people that we care about, and that also means that we start winning elections to put people in who have better character and values, who can be trusted in. With the precious positions that, the presidency on down. And, I think we got very complacent. I think many of us, certainly Democrats, just were very overconfident that there's just no possible way that this election was, that we're going to lose this election. And we just cannot. And I think that was a big reason why. And I think, by the way, it wasn't just us. I think it was the media. It was everybody. Nobody really took seriously the prospect that Trump might win. And that's a big reason why he did win.
I agree. And I think a lot of people who sat it out for various reasons, or because they weren't enthusiastic about the Democratic candidate, would have held their noses and voted if not for the widespread perception that it was all but in the bag for Hillary Clinton. Harold, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. I really do appreciate it. And I would very much like to have you back on in, say, a month to talk about the efforts to repeal the ACA and whatever else comes down the pike.
I'm optimistic about some of that stuff, so I'd be happy to talk to you about it. I should say I'm the most optimistic person that I know among my friends, even though I'm the person who's talking about potentially going to jail, which is kind of funny.
Well, you might be more optimistic than I am at this point. Harold Pollack, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you, sir. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
I'd also like to thank Billy Wimsatt. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall, and you can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes or Podbean or SoundCloud or wherever else you can find it. I'd like to thank Heather Digby, partner over at Hullabaloo, the good folks at Crooks and Liars, and the smirking Trump for letting me host the show over at their joints. And of course, I would like to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.
Il est midi. 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 Il est midi. Il est midi.
C'est l'heure de déjeuner. C'est l'heure. C'est l'heure de déjeuner. De déjeuner. C'est l'heure de déjeuner.
Qu'est-ce qu'il y a à manger ? Qu'est-ce qu'il y a ?